KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for listening. It's nice to be with you. We are in for a sunny week with temperatures rising, starting especially on Wednesday, and it will go up to almost 60 degrees by the end of the week. Tonight and Tuesday night, it will still be below freezing, but after that, temperatures are predicted to rise up into the 30s at night. Although I wouldn't bring any plants out yet, I do believe that spring is here because the deer in our backyard are showing up in shaggy coats. Their fur is coming off in big clumps. So that's got to mean something. This being Monday, here's a roundup of last week's state news and Iowa stories in the national news provided by the Iowa Informer, iowainformer.com. The Iowa legislature passed a bill that would prevent the Iowa Supreme Court from ruling that a law is unconstitutional unless at least five of its seven members concur. This came less than a week after passing a bill effectively banning most abortions in the state, with no exceptions for rape or incest. This abortion bill can be seen as contradicting U.S. Supreme Court decisions establishing that a woman has a right to an abortion until fetal viability. All but three of the state's Senate's Republican members voted for the court supermajority legislation, which narrowly passed 26-24. Independent state Senator David Johnson, a former Republican from Ochiden, called the bill, quote, a dangerous move, sheer madness. In an editorial, the Cedar Rapids Gazette wrote, quote, in a state house with a seemingly unlimited supply of bad ideas, this is one among the worst of 2018. They pointed out that a supermajority law recently prevented the North Dakota Supreme Court from declaring a similarly strict abortion ban unconstitutional. The law was ultimately struck down by a federal court, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review its decision. The only other state with a supermajority Supreme Court law is Nebraska. All 29 of the Iowa Senate's Republican members voted for a separate bill that would require the names of candidates from the party whose most recent gubernatorial candidate received the most votes to be placed first on the ballots. It passed along party lines, with Democrats decrying it as a blatantly partisan power grab. State Senator Matt McCoy, a Des Moines Democrat, said that his GOP colleagues have become, quote, drunk with power, unquote. The bill would benefit Republicans who have held the governor's mansion since Terry Branstad's return to office in 2011. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate has begun the so-called soft rollout of the new voter ID law, which was passed by the state legislature last year. Although the law doesn't take effect until next January, Pate has instructed poll workers to ask for voter IDs, saying anyone who does not have the necessary ID will be asked to sign an oath verifying their identity and will be allowed to cast a regular ballot. Next year, voters without state-issued photo IDs are supposed to automatically receive voter ID cards in the mail, although this is a concern for college students and other residents with out-of-state or outdated addresses. Pate has claimed that the voter ID law won't disenfranchise voters, as similar laws have in other states. However, early signs of trouble emerged last Tuesday during a Polk County special election for a rejected sales tax increase. Voters reported poorly trained poll workers who were unfamiliar with the oath verifying their identity. Appearing to think that the new law had already taken effect, some poll workers refused to let people vote without showing identification or allow them to vote only after they refused to back down. At times, poll workers reportedly only allowed voters to cast provisional ballots. On Thursday, President Trump announced his plan to impose tariffs on imported steel and aluminum in order to safeguard the country's industrial base, sparking concern about trade wars. On March 7th, every member of Iowa's congressional delegation, five Republicans and one Democrat, sent a letter to Trump also opposing the tariffs, saying they, quote, could send into motion a chain of retaliatory measures hurting Iowans from the family farm to the farm-owned manufacturing plant, unquote. According to a Friday Des Moines Register Clark Kaufman, retired Plymouth Judge Edward Jacobson, recently admitted that maybe a, quote, couple hundred, unquote, court decisions he authored were actually ghostwritten by attorneys arguing the case. He also admitted that he did not always notify opposing counsel that this was happening. Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady said Jacobson's actions threatened to undermine, quote, public confidence in our system of justice, unquote. Other attorneys and a Drake law professor who spoke with Kaufman also condemned the judge's actions. Jacobson's admission was made in a deposition last fall. He retired after 16 years on the bench last October. And those are some of the news from the Iowa Informer, iowainformer.com, of Iowa State News and Iowa News in the National News. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Thanks for listening. KHOI Elections reporter Cal Halliburton has been offering a series of interviews with candidates who will be running in the primaries this June. We call it Candidates with Cal. During the past week, he brought Democratic candidates for the U.S. Representative for the 4th District, one of the Republican candidates, Dr. Cindy Hansen. She's running against Representative Stephen King. We also contacted Representative King for an interview, but he declined. Here's Cal with Dr. Cindy Hansen.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Dr. Cindy Hansen. Dr. Hansen is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Republican nomination as a candidate for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa. Cindy grew up in Castanna, a tiny Monona County town near the Maple River in western Iowa, and graduated from Maple Valley High School in Mapleton. After graduating from Briarcliff University in Sioux City, she embarked on a human resource management career for 15 years. During that time, she was a consultant with Rayford & Associates, a training specialist with Great West Casualty Company, and president of the Siouxland Society for Human Resource Management. Hansen then made a career shift, completing a master's degree at Drake University and a doctorate in education from the University of South Dakota. Dr. Hansen is currently the executive director of the College Center in South Sioux City, Nebraska, an academic center operated jointly by Northeast Community College and Wayne State College, where she leads a team of 13 employees. She and her 9-year-old daughter reside in Sioux City, Iowa.
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine?
That's a great question. I think the thing that most people notice about me right away once you meet me in person, but you're probably not going to find it on a search engine, is that I'm a positive, smiling person. You normally will see me smiling, enthusiastic about life, just very positive outlook on what can be accomplished and what can be done with focus and determination.
I understand that you've traveled already to all 39 counties in the district.
I have, yep. I've been to all 39 counties. I tried to count up the number of communities the other day, and I think around 80 different communities.
Well, as you've talked with people throughout the district, what are their most frequent concerns?
That's one of the questions I've been asking people. What are your number one concerns, and what are the things that you want your representatives to be really attending to? And a couple of things come to mind. The first one very often is fiscal responsibility. A lot of concern with our national debt, and, you know, it continues to rise. We're seeing that, and people are very concerned about what that means for the future. So really drawing in spending. I've not had anyone say, raise my taxes. Which is to be expected, but, you know, a lot of people are very concerned that we're spending more as a government than we're taking in. Healthcare also continues to be a concern, a very frequent expression. The expense of healthcare. I've heard from numerous people who are spending more than their mortgage for healthcare coverage, which is not sustainable. It's really a drain. Economic concerns are the largest concern that comes out overall.
Well, let's assume you've been elected. What are your top priorities?
It ties right into that, the economic areas. My top priority is really looking at reducing spending. And a lot of people start to then ask more questions about that. And I think the biggest area that we can focus on immediately is reducing government bloat. Having worked with government organizations before in various positions, I think there's a lot of bloat within departments of the government. And that happens over time if there aren't restrictions put in place where governments or departments create regulation, which requires more people to enforce the regulation, which then prompts the need for more regulation. So it's a cycle. And I think it's time that we take a look and really look at how can we reduce the amount of regulation that is not really producing any impact, and then subsequently reduce the size of those departments. I think that's the biggest area to see potential reduction in government spending.
It's always a question then, what exactly would you do to accomplish those kinds of changes that you're looking to make happen?
It's engaging in the process, moving away from continuing budget resolutions and moving to an actual budgeting process. And I know Senator Ernst is also working in that direction, representing the state of Iowa as well, that we've got to move away from these continuing resolutions that are just short-term, quick fixes that really does not enable the process, the House and the Senate, to really look at what is the budget and what are we spending on. It's just a quick fix, short-term spending bill, rather than an actual budgeting process of saying, okay, we're going to cut here, we need to reduce here, and allocate the way that we need to. So it's taking those steps, being involved in the process, and making it a priority to move to the process as it's intended to be.
There are some other issues that come up. For example, there's an opioid crisis.
Yes.
Currently. Is there a particular action that you could take as a new representative to deal with that problem?
You know, I think a lot of issues like that, the opioid crisis certainly is a nationwide issue. So there is a role for the federal government in that. I tend to be very much in favor of local control of as much as possible. It's not that I would really structure a federal program to deal with the opioid crisis, but I think there are some things that go into place with that, like connecting medical records so that doctors know if people are doctor shopping, to increase the number of prescriptions that they have because a number of people are using prescriptions to support their habit in that way. So those are some things. But as far as the actual implementation of programs, I think it varies state by state, community by community, and that's where local control is very necessary and really the better response than a federal response.
So you're not sure there's any role for the federal government?
I think it's an oversight role, a coordination role. And some of the funding can come through grant programs and things as states design their own programs. That's where I see the federal government's role, not as an administrator of the program.
You did mention healthcare as one of the issues that comes up a lot. Are there some specific things that you think you can do as a congressperson?
I think, unfortunately, the healthcare industry and insurance overall, we focused a long time on who pays health insurance and not so much on how do we make the healthcare industry more efficient. And I've worked with a couple of the hospitals, and well, one of the hospitals in Sioux City on some performance improvement processes that they're going through that's really designed to increase efficiency in how they operate. Similar to what I'm talking about, what I talked about earlier with the federal government, how can we look at making processes more efficient so we have less overhead? Those are the kind of things I think that we need to engage in. A lot of times the conversation is involving insurance companies and not necessarily healthcare providers as much as we need to. So we need to shift from looking at who pays to how do we structure our system and what are the ways that we can create efficiency. Consumer-driven healthcare is something that interests me, having been on plans that are both high deductible and then traditional plans. Even being aware of my own spending habits, I will tell you that you engage in healthcare differently depending on how much skin you have in the game. And so I think there's a lot of different avenues that we need to pursue that gets into making consumers better educated about what choices they have, reducing pressure from lobbyists and special interests that are really designed to push their own agendas that aren't necessarily always about health, but sometimes just about continuing treatment, and really engage in the overall process. That's not a short fix. And that's the challenge, is everybody wants to see this happen quickly. We didn't get into a situation where healthcare is more expensive than a mortgage quickly. That's happened over time. So it's going to take some time to fix, but it starts by having conversations about what's the low-hanging fruit. Where can we start with that process? And I think part of it is engaging the right people in the conversation that are looking for a change, not just a change in who's paying.
I recall an essay by Charles Krautheimer not long ago that created quite a bit of stir when he suggested that we're on our way to a single-payer system.
You know, a lot of people speculate that as well. And I think as costs continue to increase, it could push in that direction because people simply won't be able to afford it anymore. I mean, as I said, I don't think it's sustainable for a family to pay more for their health insurance than for their home. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, people will just opt not to do that. And then we'll have more people that are by default moving on to a government system. And rather than having that happen by default, I'm a more proactive person. I'd like to try to fix the problem before we get there.
How about gun control? That's another issue that's got buzzwords, and I can't imagine you haven't been
Well, certainly
asked
over
about
the last
that.
2 weeks, it's been a hot issue, absolutely. It's an unfortunate situation that we've had, the amount of violence in our society that we have, and so much that has involved guns. And it's an issue, certainly, that we have violence in our society. I'm not in favor of extended federal mandates in regards to most anything. And so gun control really falls into that area as well. I do think, however, as a compassionate person and someone who tries to put myself in other people's positions from time to time, that it's time to engage in conversation, real conversation about what are the areas of agreement that Democrats, Republicans, independents, libertarians, whatever, can come to about as a society. How can we address this issue? Because it's very obvious that there's a growing amount of violence in our country. And so how can we address that? And what are the areas that we can start to have the real conversation about instead of being extremely polarized? You know, that's one of the issues that we've had over the last 5, 10 years or so, is that everyone is entrenched in a polar position instead of engaging in the conversation, saying, okay, let's find a point of agreement and start to work from that point. And I think there are those points of agreements that we can come to when talking about access to guns, background checks, those sorts of things that don't completely infringe on the Second Amendment, because I do support people's individual right to bear arms. But I think we also need to look at systemically what are some points of agreement that we can have. And that starts with a conversation.
How do you get people out of the trenches where they're locked into a particular position and refuse to compromise on anything? What do you do as a congresswoman to do that?
It starts with one-on-one conversations. And again, I know sometimes we look at the federal government, we say, well, it's impossible to change. I don't think anything's impossible. I think it all starts with one-on-one individual conversations, individual people getting in there. And part of it is changing the players that are involved, which is why I'm in this race to begin with. If we want to have people who are willing to have conversations, we got to put them in office.
Another issue that pops up frequently is, and is also current in the news, is immigration. What's your position there?
On immigration overall, it's definitely time to do a comprehensive reform of our immigration system. And by comprehensive, I mean that we really need to look at it in its totality. So part of that does include securing our borders. I'm not a strong proponent of a physical wall. In its entirety, I think there are portions of our border that a physical barrier may be appropriate. But I think securing our border by use of physical barrier, personnel, electronic monitoring, drones, all kinds of things is appropriate. I think that's a component of it, but that's not the total immigration reform that I'm talking about. So securing our borders is one, because that helps then to discourage, in other ways, illegal immigration. But I think there are other things that we can do that also discourage illegal immigration. You know, often it's said the best defense is a good offense. So I think we need to look at our immigration policies. I do support more merit-based immigration. I think our economy, one of the things that I've been, as I've talked with business people, that's a common comment is that I can't find workers. And about 5 years ago, it was I can't find skilled workers, and now it's just I can't find workers. So as an economy, particularly in Northwest Iowa, we need people. And so part of it means that we need to bring more people to Northwest Iowa, whether that's from other parts of the United States or other parts of the world. And so immigration is an important piece of that. So encouraging merit-based immigration is part of it. I do support some aspects of family-based immigration because I do support unification of families. You know, as a mother myself, I see the value in having your immediate family together. So I support that as well. So some of the things I think we need to look at are the delays that it takes for people to legally immigrate to the country, and depending on what country you're from. So reevaluating the quotas or the caps that we have for particular countries and saying, does this still serve the country? Because it's been over 30 years since we've done any comprehensive immigration reform. So really asking the questions, does this serve the United States in the position that we are in today?
It's been our pleasure today to be talking with you. And I was wondering before we close if there's anything else that you'd like to say.
You know, the one thing that I always just like to leave people with is that if we expect a different result, if we really are not wanting the same thing continually, then you have to send different people. And that means sending people that are just like you. And that's who I am. You know, I'm just a regular, hardworking Iowan. I encourage everyone else to do that the same. So I would appreciate their support. You can find me on Facebook at Cindy Hansen for Iowa, or you can find me at Hansen, the number 4, Iowa.com, and that's Hansen with an O-N.
It's been our pleasure today talking with Dr. Cindy Hansen, who's a candidate for the Republican Party nomination for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa.
Thank you, Cal.
Thank you, Cal. In the next few weeks, we will be moving on with Candidates with Cal, with candidates running in other June primaries. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. I'm not sure if I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm sorry. We've been bringing you a series of interviews with people living here in Iowa who are from the African continent. The series began when our president made well-known derogatory remarks about countries in Africa, and this piqued our curiosity. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has since traveled to Africa. Prior to his trip to several countries in Africa, he referred to the growing competition from Chinese investments in Africa. Chinese investment now is about at $40 billion, and although the U.S. investment is currently more than that, at approximately $58 billion, U.S. investment has been on the decline. Pepra, a Ghanaian student at Iowa State University, sat down with me last week to introduce us to his country. We started out our conversation with him describing his home country, Ghana.
Ghana is a beautiful place. It's a beautiful country, beautiful people, very rich in culture, very hospitable people, great music. Yeah. The nightlife is amazing. Great music, great culture, great weather. Accra is, it's like the major city where fun stuff is happening.
So you grew up in Accra?
Yeah, I did. Maybe 30 minutes outside of Accra is a little, it's a smaller city called Tema, which is where I live. I'd say one of the tougher things that Ghana's cities are struggling with is bad roads. But outside of bad roads, I'd say that it looks just like any other city. Houses are built out of bricks and cement.
So they look similar to the brick houses you see?
Yeah, here? Yeah, in Iowa. And I actually live like 10 minutes away from a KFC. One big difference between a lot of Iowa homes and where I live is that most houses in Accra are usually enclosed by a wall, whereas Iowa, you get out of your house and you can see your neighbor's driveway and stuff like that. We don't really have that in Accra.
What's a popular dish?
Jollof rice.
Like? Say it again?
Jollof rice. It's rice that's cooked in a sauce. So you kind of make the sauce separately and then you toss rice in it and it's all cooked into the sauce. It all cooks together. Kind of the flavor really comes from the sauce that you make, that you cook. And it's kind of an African, the war between Ghana, Nigeria, and a lot of West African countries about who makes the best jollof rice.
Do you know how to make it?
My roommates and I, we watched a YouTube video of how to make it and made it one weekend. So
when you think of the culture of Ghana, what does it feel like to you?
Every time I go home, I'm just like, I have to leave here again. But it's just this level of peace. People are very hospitable. People are all looking out for each other. I felt like I had like 30 mothers. If my parents weren't home, I could go to my neighbor's house and get a meal for dinner while my parents, you know. So it was just that kind of atmosphere where the culture of Ghana is, it's a very family-oriented culture. Think of Iowa, but in Africa, in Ghana.
So what was life like? What did you do as a child?
One thing that I guess we as a country struggle with is organized youth activities. So I didn't really get to participate in youth sports and things of that nature, you know, school band and stuff like that, where it's like you have practice every night. And I didn't really have that growing up. However, I got that in my neighborhood. I grew up in a community where all the neighborhood kids formed our own sort of youth activity. So I would come home after school and all the kids in the neighborhood would all get together and play soccer till 6 at night and we'll all go home and to our family. So even though I didn't get that structured school activities, I can't remember one night where I was not playing some sort of game or, you know, activity with the friends, with my kids I grew up with. Yeah, so I got that.
Did you experience markets in Accra?
I live 5-10 minutes from a market now. I think when we explain the market, so just think of like a huge field with people selling all kinds of groceries. So instead of walking to Walmart, think of like the farmer's market.
Like a big farmer's
market. A big farmer's market. That's what a market is. And that's where 90% of grocery shopping is done in Ghana. Agriculture is a huge sector in Ghana. If you were to get out of the cities into kind of like the villages, I would say your average Ghanaian family rely on their household income from farming practices. So either yams or bananas, a lot of grains, millet, corn, or rice, or tomatoes, or cocoa, whatever it is. That's how a lot of them generate household income, is from farming. Ghana is the second largest producer of cocoa.
When you think of Ghana, one of the things that comes to mind are beautiful materials.
Yeah.
In the market, do women tend to wear fabrics like that?
Yes.
Do you see that a lot, the fabrics?
Yeah. In Ghana, you can go to places where you can watch people hand weaving these fabrics. So it's a major product. Everybody wears them.
Did you wear fabrics like that when you
were
young?
I still have them.
Do you enjoy wearing them?
I do. I do enjoy it. It's culture. It's you. Like, it's just, if you were to get to, like, down to the roots of what Africa is, it's a huge part of our culture. I know a lot of corporations in Ghana have this thing called Friday wear, where instead of suits, they're allowed to wear these fabrics. And so everybody's in their vibrant colors. This is what we wore. Our ancestors didn't wear suits and white shirts, ties and slacks and dress shoes. Like, this is what they wore when they would go to any event, be it a wedding, funeral. I love it.
Just joined us, I'm Ursula Rudenberg. We're hearing from Pepra, a student from Iowa State University, who agreed to come into KHOI and allow me to ask him about his home country. One thing immediately apparent about Pepra, and you may have noticed this already, is that he sounds pretty much like an American. Pepra came to the U.S. when he was only 15. He said that for a while he sounded very different, but with time he sounds less and less African. However, he told me that experiences he had when he was ridiculed for his accent when he first came to the United States have led him to feel that Americans should be more open-minded and less dismissive of people with accents. As we continued speaking, Pepra told me about how he ended up in Iowa.
I followed my brother here because he got a scholarship to come play basketball, and it all worked out where I could come to high school here and then eventually college. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, basketball was the main reason why we got here, my brother and I.
And why did you come here? What was your motivation?
I mean, America is the land of opportunity. I'm not saying there's not opportunity back home. There is, mm-hmm. but there's just a little bit more here. Probably a little better education system, and you get exposed to a much broader range of opportunities is one of the reasons why we moved here.
Were your parents worried about you when you came here?
I mean, my mom was worried more so because I was so young. I was only 15. I was really immature, and she was just kind of leaving me here. But it was, I guess, a leap of faith for my parents, and I think it's worked out. And that's one of the things I really appreciate from them, is just like putting their trust in me and allowing me to just kind of grow on my own, even though it was tough for them. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten any trouble yet, so.
Was it hard to move?
Initially it was, but we were blessed with a great support system when we came here. So all 4 years in high school, I lived with several different host families that over a period of time have become family. And so we had a great support system in Iowa, which made it a much easier transition than mm-hmm. it would have been.
Were these people Ghanaians?
No,
they were Americans.
Yeah, they're Americans.
And how did they connect with you?
The NGO that brought my brother here. So freshman year, I used to live with Jake, who kind of brought my brother over. And Jake lived in Huxley. And my high school was in Des Moines. So it was like a 45, 35-minute drive to school every day. And then, you know, in the freezing cold and the snow, that made it almost an hour, right? And mm-hmm. so I was late to class all the time. And so Jake kind of reached out to one of the families that was in his NGO. And like, hey, I have this boy that's lived with me, but he just lives way too far from high school, and would you be willing to take him in? And so I moved in with four different families when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. Once you got here, were you happy that you had come? Did you feel that it was what you wanted it to be?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been that and even more. Even though I've been away from, I mean, my parents have kind of missed out on us growing up, but I still think that it's been the greatest blessing in my life. Personally, I've grown so much just being away from my parents and like having to think for yourself, and just the independence of not being with your parents. It allows you to grow up. You're forced to make decisions without any guidance. And so that has really helped me. I think it's really matured me a lot. So it's been good.
And are you planning to return to home?
Yeah, I hope to go back home and start my own business and start a nonprofit as well.
What do you want to start up?
I enjoy fitness. Like, I like being active. I enjoy playing basketball, lifting weights. However, I've noticed that in Ghana, there's not, like, premier facilities to be able to live an active life. Whenever I go back home, there's a gym I go to, but it's not as nice as you would find an American gym here. And so one of my goals is go back home and try to build like a premier gym facility with, you know, basketball gym, like a basketball setting, and there's a nice weightlifting area and a nice smoothie bar. You know, so something a little bit higher quality than most Ghanaians are used to. Yeah.
So you're kind of a new generation of entrepreneurs, really.
Yeah, there's a lot of young entrepreneurs in Ghana now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it stems, there's like a boom in Ghana of college graduates. And high supply of college graduates, that creates an imbalance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. College graduates not being able to get corporate jobs out of college. It's gotten to a point where it really depends on who you know to be able to get a job. Mm-hmm. And so what has happened is there's been a boom in the private sector. Mm-hmm. I know the government is really pushing for the private sector as well. A lot of youth in Ghana struggle trying to get financing for any ideas. And I know this new government that just got in power a couple of years ago are really pushing for regulating banks to be a little more lenient on loan structures for people that are trying to start businesses. And I think the government themselves are starting their own little program where if you can apply for like a loan to start your own business as well. America is great in its own too, but there's no place like home. But yeah, I'm definitely going to move back home. I don't know when that is, but eventually I definitely want to move back home.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah,
really appreciate it. We really have the opportunity to use your eyes and your experiences to make this real instead of, you know, something over there.
Right. I mean, there's always going to be misconceptions about Africa or South America or Europe. I just urge people, like, go see for yourself. It's easier said than done, but it's going to be completely worth it. You'd quickly realize that a lot of things that are said, for example, what Trump said, that, oh, it's just these bleep hole countries, you'd quickly realize that it's not the case, and that these countries are actually filled with a lot of beauty and a lot of culture that you never experience if you just never go check it out for yourself.
KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host, here with Keith Morgan, who has just joined us. Keith is Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County. It is spring, Keith, and we're going to talk tornadoes, thunderstorms, flash floods. Oh, my.
Yeah, we're getting there towards spring. This morning, it was a little bit warmer than what it was in January.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So let's talk about tornadoes.
Tornadoes, the information or the data on the 2017 tornadoes came out. We experienced 55 tornadoes here in Iowa. We had one relatively major tornado. Yes, in 2017. Uh-huh. The town of Seymour was hit by a tornado. We saw a lot of it on television. The community came together great afterwards, but the high school in the small town was pretty much destroyed. And that is another reminder that tornadoes can happen. And the 2017 data showed that we had tornadoes as early as February and as late as December in 2017. So they can happen. Mm-hmm. We're already into the tornado season, and it's time for us to start thinking about not just tornadoes but severe weather in general.
Yep. It's spring.
You know,
spring in Iowa.
Last year, we had 9 counties receive presidential disaster declarations, most of it in late summer of 2017. It wasn't due to tornadoes. It was due to flooding and some severe weather, the straight-line winds and like that.
I've learned from you, Keith, from working with you, is that the highest level of deaths from natural disasters in Iowa is from flash flooding.
It is from flooding. It's one of those things where people almost like to go out and put themselves in danger when it comes to that. Or it's very deceptive because the water levels oftentimes don't indicate how deep the water is or what's happened underneath that water that's out there. That's why we're having Severe Weather Awareness Week. It's an annual event. This year it's going to be occurring between March 26th and March 30th. And what we're going to try and do during that week is to educate people about all of the different kinds of threats that are out there.
Can you give us a little bit of a preview?
Well, what we're looking for, first off, is we're going to use this week to try and get families. We really encourage businesses to also start thinking about it, and us as governmental agencies will start to review our plans that we have for severe weather. This is a great time also that if you have new people in your business or if your child is going to a different school, to look over your plans because either they may not remember what you had for your plans or the plans will be different for them because of those changes. It's also a time to check out your equipment, make sure you've got everything that you're going to need, first off, to try and reduce the impact of these storms, and secondly, if they do occur, to make sure that you're prepared to react to them. That's part of that's looking at your preparedness kit. This weekend, I had the excitement of trying to find a replacement weather radio because mine's starting to get old, and it's starting to fall apart. So got online, and I looked for a new weather radio so I can get that alert that bad things are coming. Changing the batteries and the flashlights that you've got in your severe weather kits, testing out the radios, and we're going to talk a little bit later about how you can test out those weather radios, and swap out that food that you've got, food and water that you have in your disaster kit. Have a disaster night where the family eats off of that food that you got in your disaster kit. It'll be exciting for the kids, and it'll also really test whether you're putting food in there that you'd really want to eat during
a
disaster.
It's a good idea. I think that would be memorable.
Yeah,
kind of give you a dry run.
It gives you a dry run. It can get the kids involved. You can review any plans that you might have. Have a candlelight dinner using the candles that you should have in your kit, or maybe just that flashlight to eat by. I think your kids and the family might enjoy that. Even turn the TV off. I'm sorry, but that can be done. And just have that kind of that interesting evening.
So, folks, what does Keith Morgan want? Keith Morgan wants you to be prepared.
Be prepared. Hopefully you never have to use this stuff, but if you do, again, you're going to really, really want it when that time comes. So.
Okay, so let's talk about weather threats. What types of weather threats are we looking at?
We're going to start off with lightning. It is probably the most prevalent threat that you're going to experience out there, but it's the one that's probably the least respected. When you hear there's a saying we have, turn around, don't drown. Well, one of them is when thunder roars, it's time to go indoors. Because if you can hear it.
When thunder roars, it's time to go indoors.
Yep. If you can hear thunder, then the lightning is close enough. And sometimes lightning can actually strike even though it doesn't appear that the clouds are directly above you. So that's why you have to take it seriously. The other part to it is to give yourself time to adequately protect yourself. If you are outside, the first thing is get away from all those tall objects that might be around you. Mm-hmm. And here's another one. You hear me keep talking about businesses. A lot of businesses have people that are doing outdoor activities. Do you have a plan? Do you have criteria when your workers are supposed to come inside and protect themselves from the possibility of lightning? So that's one of the starting points. A lot of outdoor activities. Again, if you have organized sports, are there criteria where you will stop those organized sports and get the players in and into safety is one of the top things to think about when it comes to lightning. The next thing we'll look at is flooding. Just like you said, more people die from flooding than all of the other disasters. And again, it's because people don't respect it. We've said it over and over again, turn around, don't drown. Mm-hmm. But when you see on TV, what do you see? People stranded in cars in the middle of the flooded water.
So the turnaround refers to when you're in your car, go home instead of keep going.
That's one of the areas. But again, also, we had a death in eastern Iowa where people were in and near water just walking around, and they did not anticipate that there was a storm drain, went into the water, got sucked through that storm drain. Mm-hmm. That's one of the problems. The water is murky. You ought to be scared to go into the water in the first place. No telling what kind of stuff has been mixed in with that water. Mm-hmm. But what's under the water is what's dangerous. There are now holes that weren't there before. You can slip, fall in, and then get pushed along the water. The force of the water is much, much greater than a lot of people actually mm-hmm. anticipate. And if you're driving, yes, the road may have been there when you started out this morning, but with the water rushing by it, it may be gone. So mm-hmm. just don't take a chance. Turn around. Don't drown. Take a little bit longer to get where you need to go. Mm-hmm. But along with that, some of the equipment you need to be checking to protect your house is check your sump pumps. Pour a little bit of water into those sump pumps this spring. Make sure that they're activating, that they haven't got a little bit of corrosion that's keeping the float from activating it. If you have battery backup, check the batteries to make sure that those will be working. Check your downspouts. Make sure they're clean. You want to push that water away from your house as far as you can mm-hmm. and get that all taken care of before we have that first big deluge, which will come quicker than we probably anticipate. If you live near a river, the National Weather Service has got a great website to go, and you can monitor those rivers and see how quickly the water's raising. And if there's a chance for flooding, they'll go ahead and put graphs there to show you when they anticipate the crest is going to be and how high it's going to be. So you can stay informed, and you can make sure to protect yourself, but have that plan to be able to get out of there should the weather. Have your very valuable documents all in one place so you can gather them and go if you need to. But then we'll get to the ones that we anticipate an awful lot more. That's the severe thunderstorms.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Monitor the weather. Look at those. Look at the radar. Oftentimes, you can see these storms coming from a long ways away.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, we had hail last week, right?
There was some hail. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. here in Ames, mm-hmm. and that's the start. In the spring is when we get the tornadoes, and then as the summer goes along, then we tend to have the high winds mm-hmm. and the hail. The apps that you can get for your phone from the different TV stations are great. The National Weather Service also has a great app that you can look at. You can bring up those the radar and see what's the status of the storms right now so that you can plan ahead and try and make things safe.
Mm-hmm.
Around your house, check to make sure that there are no branches hanging out over your house. Get somebody in there that's an expert when it comes to trimming the trees. There's a lot that they can do to help preserve those trees by thinning them out a bit. But again, I recommend having an expert do it instead of trying to climb those mm-hmm. trees on your own.
Another thing I learned last thunderstorm was the thunderstorm, if there's lightning near your house, it's better not to be on the phone.
There's
the electricity can come through the phone.
That is for the old-fashioned
The hand phones.
The hand phones. There's a little less risk if you have the portable phones because you're not going to be hooked up directly.
Right.
But if you have the old-fashioned phone, if the power goes out, you'll still have a telephone if you have a landline. Whereas if the other one depends on battery or mm-hmm. the electricity, you won't have that capability.
But so use your cell phone.
Use your cell phone, yeah. But the cell phone systems after storms
can
tend to
down.
Get clogged with a lot of people calling on.
Yeah.
Also, try and stay away from water as much as possible mm-hmm. during mm-hmm. electrical storm
right.
because it's a great conductor on there. One important part is, again, to have a plan, especially mm-hmm. if you're in a business and severe weather is coming. Nursing homes and schools and businesses all have plans. Parents and families need to also so that they can figure out where everybody's at after the storm has moved through and that everybody is safe and how they're going to get back together again.
So, Keith, there are websites where you can go to help you kind of run this through, right? I mean, I'm thinking about the person who's thinking, so where do I start?
A great place to start. We have a preparedness link on our website, StoryCountyIowa.gov/EMA. The National Weather Service has hours and hours of information for you to look at. They're another great place to go. And also to familiarize.
Where do you find them?
I have them bookmarked. If you
so
just
weather.gov?
Weather.gov sounds correct.
Uh-huh.
I would just do a Google search for National Weather Service Des Moines.
Okay.
And the good thing about going to the Des Moines site is it's going to be information that's much more focused on here in Iowa.
In Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing we have is tornadoes. They're the most destructive, least likely of the weather. The key is, just like the other storms, watch the weather. Be aware mm-hmm. of what's going on. If you're outdoor, those outdoor warning sirens are meant for people that are outdoor, and they mean get inside. I've had people ask, well, because we can now activate the sirens for straight line winds of 70 miles an hour or hail, golf ball size or bigger, how do I know the difference? You really don't care. It's going to be bad if you're outside. Get inside. Get mm-hmm. better weather. Those apps that you can put on your cell phone, another great way to get information on potential storms and like that. So I really encourage folks, if you are involved in a tornado, get as far inside the house as you can or get down into the basement and try and cover yourself. And the weather radio at night is probably the most important thing for you to have to wake mm-hmm. you up and to get you to safety if something should happen.
Get away from windows, right?
Get away from windows.
Yeah. Is it true that it's a myth that the southwest corner of the house is the safest?
There are a lot of myths out there about opening windows and everything. The safest place is as low as you can get, as far in as you can get. And also, look at the structure around you. Underneath the stairs, usually the stairs themselves have got some pretty hefty beams mm-hmm. that will protect you. Getting under something like a pool table is another way to protect yourself.
Something heavy.
Something mm-hmm. heavy, something that's going to keep falling items from hitting you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You get a chance to practice that. They're going to have a statewide tornado drill. It's going to be on March 28th. They're going to start off at 10 o'clock with a simulated tornado watch, which, as you remember.
Who's they?
The National Weather Service.
Okay.
The tornado is going to simulate a watch, which means that the conditions are right for the formation of tornadoes. There's not one now. Then they're going to transition to it about 15 minutes later to a warning, which means that there's a tornado near you and that you should go ahead and react to it.
How do you participate in this?
They're going to activate your weather radio that I'm sure you've got at your house.
Mm-hmm.
And as they activate it, then walk through your tornado plan. Make sure that everything's there to be able to protect yourself during these kinds of events.
Keith, we got 1 minute left. Anything else?
The main thing is just to practice and be aware.
It's spring.
It's springtime and it's coming.
Okay. Thank you. And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org, and you can find archives of this show and past Local Talk shows with links to guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live at KHOIFM. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Stay safe this spring, and thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.